Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're getting a look at who's taking advantage of early voting. More than 21 million ballots were mailed to registered California voters last month. As of this morning, roughly 10% have been returned. That number comes from Political Data, which tracks voter turnout across the state. Paul Mitchell is the vice president and joins us now with a breakdown of these returns. Good morning, Paul. It is that time of year again.
It is, and thanks for having me again.
Well, voting is literally delivered to our doorsteps. Ballots were mailed to every registered voter about 3 weeks ago. What does a 10% return so far mean?
Well, we've done a lot of things to actually make voting easier, like you're suggesting, the mailing of ballots to everybody. You don't even need a stamp to return the ballots anymore. We have record voter registration. We've made it easier to register. We've made it easier to update your voter registration whenever you move. So all these things we've done to try to facilitate the voting process. But what I think this 10% means is you can't really overcome an election that just isn't as interesting to voters. At this point in the gubernatorial recall election just last year, we were at 7 million votes already have been cast, and right now we're at 2.1 million. So really, it's one of those issues like you can have, free parking at the arena and low cost tickets, but if the game isn't interesting, people won't show up.
Yeah, I guess those ballots are kind of sitting with the stack of mail that a lot of us have in our living rooms. Where does this actually stack up to prior midterm years?
Well, what's interesting is your midterm gubernatorial election cycles, the primaries are always historically the lowest type of statewide election. We can look back at 2018, which was 37% turnout, 2014, which was 25% turnout, 2010, so on and so on. The primaries in gubernatorial elections are generally the lowest turnout. Now, the catch is that we have more votes being cast right now than we had in 2014, when only 4.7 million people cast ballots. And we're likely to have maybe as many ballots cast as in 2018, but we just have so many more voters. In 2014, there were only 17 million voters. Now we have 22 million voters. And so the share of the electorate that's participating is gonna look lower, even though the raw numbers of people who return ballots will be higher than 2014 and potentially reach the 2018 levels.
Yeah, I mean, this recall was just 9 months ago. Mm-hmm. What role do you think this has on voter turnout for the primary?
Well, I think that in an alternate universe, we could have a primary election where on the Republican side, Larry Elder was running for governor, where you had a lot of interest and enthusiasm and excitement on the Republican side. And that would probably also draw out more Democrats because the election would just be more interesting. All the top tier candidates that ran in that recall were people that we expected to run in this election cycle, but having come in single digits or, basically burned through all of their donor base, they didn't have the ability to kind of turn around immediately and, get ready for this election. And so the top tier Republican candidates that could have been on this ballot just aren't. And that's due to the recall.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a lack of engagement or even a lack of excitement when it comes to this primary. If you're running a campaign or you're a candidate, how should they interpret these returns and potentially a lackluster turnout overall?
Well, what's interesting is when you have this lower turnout, then really, honestly, the data is much, much, much more important. If you say we're sending a mailer and every mailer costs you a dollar and you're just sending to every voter, every dollar mailer now costs $10 because you've got only 10% of the voters actually casting ballots. You're only influencing those people who actually end up returning their ballots. So when we actually look at PDI, the data we've built to identify likely voters and identify people who are likely to vote early, that population, it's actually at 37% turnout. So there is a segment of the electorate that can be identified as high performing and be identified as people who vote early. And so campaigns that are using effective data can actually target the people who are voting. The downside to that is that a lot of people who don't have a strong vote history might not get as many voter contacts, might not get as many mailers, and it can you know, be a little bit self-fulfilling in terms of campaigns targeting the people who they know are going to vote and not spending as much time trying to pull to the polls or to get those ballots returned from people less likely to vote.
When talking about people who take advantage of early voting, how do these primary returns break down along party lines? Is it consistent with prior years?
So, you know, decades ago, when early voting was really starting more regularly, the vote by mail universe was heavily, heavily Republican. It was a lot more suburban, white. And so as we saw early returns come in, they always skewed very, very Republican in those first ballots. That changed in 2020 in the general election when the Trump campaign and messengers on right-wing radio and Fox News were saying, oh, you can't trust vote by mail, all these conspiracy theories. And so things changed in that election, and it seems as though a lot of that still continues, where Republicans now have less faith that their ballot will be counted if they mail it in. They are more likely, they say, to vote at the polls. So the early vote, which used to skew more Republican, now skews more Democratic. What's interesting is in the underlying demographics, it's still much whiter. 70% of the early ballots came from voters who are white, only 15% from Latinos, who are, you know, 40% of the state's population and 27% of the registered voters. Seniors are less than a quarter of the ballots that were mailed out, and they're more than half of the ballots that have been returned. So we see an electorate in these early votes that is much more old, suburban, white, and not reflective of the state's true population.
Yeah, I was looking at those age demographics, and roughly they're all kind of like equal in registered voters, you know, between 24 and 26%, broken down into four categories. And the 65 plus isn't necessarily a surprise given the high returns, but the lowest return percentages are between 18 and 34, 35 and 49, 4 and 6% respectively. That's really like the future of voting in California. I mean, what does that bode?
I mean, this is a pattern that we've seen when dropout when turnout drops. It doesn't drop evenly. It doesn't mean that all groups are turning out at a lower rate. What it means is that you've got this kind of permanent voter, the older, more conservative homeowner that just is always going to vote. And the people that don't vote are the younger renters, minorities, and so on. And it is pretty shocking the way that we've broken out these age demographics. You're right, they're all kind of broken out into these four quartiles. But when you actually look at who votes, it's predominantly these seniors. And you have, you know, 18 to 34 year olds, which you're saying are really kind of the future of the California electorate and actually more representative of the population. They come in as the largest kind of chunk in terms of age groups, but they're only 11% of the people who actually return ballots. So they come in at, you know, 25% of registered, probably more like 35% of this total state's population, but they're really almost 1 in 10 of the people who actually have returned their ballots so far.
A trend that we've been seeing in recent election cycles, and your data also shows, that there's more independent and third party registered voters than Republicans. I think it's like 29% to 25% statewide. That's a more nuanced voting group. What are the challenges in outreach and perhaps gauging how they will vote?
So independents are interesting because they aren't just kind of this monolithic independent group that all thinks alike. You've got some independents who think that the Republican Party is not right-wing enough, and some independents that think that the Democratic Party isn't left-wing enough. And then you just have a lot of people who don't believe in the two-party system. And a lot of the younger voters, a lot of Latinos, are registering now as being just independent. And so you have this real variety there, but roughly it skews a lot younger. And so when you look at that independent portion of the electorate and their lower turnout, a lot of it is related to that age and demographic composition, the renter versus homeowner composition. And in primaries, a lot of them don't vote in as high numbers, potentially because they really feel like, well, it's a primary, the Democrats and Republicans are going to figure it out, and then I'm just going to vote in the general. And the challenge in this election, especially low turnout, is that a lot of these races are going to be decided in the primary. Here in Sacramento, a report in the SAC B said, well, there are these two Democrats who are going to be running in an assembly district here, and they're going to make the runoff, and people will get to vote in the general to decide the race. Well, the fact is that's not what's going to happen. The fact is that one of those Democrats is going to come in first, and come in second will be a Republican. And essentially that race will be decided in the primary. So a lot of these independents who might be thinking, well, you know, I'll make a decision in the general when the race is a head to head, they might not realize that by that point, the race might effectively be decided.
Hmm. You also have a breakdown by county. Are there certain parts of the state that are stronger in returns than others, and or even with counties that might skew more red or more blue?
Yeah, so traditionally, the Bay Area turns out in higher numbers than Southern California, and specifically Los Angeles. In LA, they haven't had the same historic vote by mail patterns. For a long time, LA was kind of the lowest vote by mail county. And the history of that kind of carries forward. You have a lot more voters who haven't voted by mail as frequently and don't have those same habits. So the Bay Area is already showing higher turnout, LA lower turnout, and the rest of Southern California lower turnout. Part of that is demographics. You have more younger Latinos, more renters in those areas than you might in, you know, Santa Clara County, in San Mateo, or in the Bay Area as a whole. So some of those demographic and age factors play into that. But, you know, it's not just a coincidence that a lot of our statewide elected officials come from the Bay Area, and that Southern California, LA candidates specifically have had more of a struggle. A lot of that has to do with the fact that, especially in these primaries, these gubernatorial primaries where we elect statewide elected offices, that the Bay Area has this inherent advantage that gets played out when we look at that turnout.
Is our state, California, unique or rare when it comes to mailing ballots to every registered voter?
Yeah, I mean, we have other states that have done it. Colorado was the state that we modeled our vote center process after. There are other states that have for decades had, you know, entirely vote by mail elections. But one of the things we're learning, I think, in this election cycle is that you can do all these things to improve access to registration and to get ballots to people and make it easy. But, you know, that doesn't create high turnout. Ironically, in Georgia right now, where it seems like they're doing everything they can to make voting harder, they're actually having turnout that's through the roof because they have elections where voters really feel like the decisions they're making there are going to help decide the future of the country. The nature of those elections, how tight they are, how hard fought they are really driving people to the polls despite the hurdles that the state has created for people to get their ballots and to return them. Whereas in California, we're making it so easy, but it seems like all these ballots are just glued to people's kitchen counters.
Do you think this is like a foreshadowing of what to expect come the general in November?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we had huge turnout just, you know, 6-7 months ago in that recall election. And the November election is 6 or so months away from now. So, you know, a lot of things can change. And I think one of the things we're looking at is what happens at the Supreme Court. We have three cases before the Supreme Court that really kind of hit the nerve of Democratic voters. One is a state of New York case that has to do with the ability of states to regulate gun control. One is a case having to do, you remember that Gay Baker case, the one that they didn't want to bake a cake for gay people. Now there's some web designer that doesn't want to make websites for the gay people. And the Supreme Court has accepted that case that could undercut a lot of protection for the LGBTQ community. And then, of course, we've seen a preview of this decision in Roe v. Wade that could strip away abortion rights nationally and immediately trigger, you know, a couple dozen states to create some form of outright ban on abortion. And not just that decision, but the decisions of states afterwards, the stories that we're going to hear of, you know, these issues around the country could really transform an electorate like California's, especially in key parts of the state where, you know, voters might be more conservative on fiscal issues, but they are pro-choice down to the bone. and might really get agitated and use the voting in November as a way to express that.
Yeah, there's just so much that's going to be taking place in the months to come. In the list, in the next 5 days until June 7th, what outliers are you interested in watching?
Well, I mean, we've been on this slow march, it feels like, to getting to this final turnout. I think some of the races that are really interesting are in LA. There's a big mayor's race. Congresswoman Karen Bass and businessman Rick Caruso are seemingly the top candidates in that race. It's a race where if one of the candidates gets 50%, then there is no runoff, but most people are expecting there to be a runoff. But that is a pivotal race in obviously the state's largest city. There are a number of competitive congressional races that will in November have a good likelihood of helping determine who controls Congress. And so we're definitely going to be watching those. There are more assembly and Senate races than we've had since 2012, with a lot of vacancies and on a lot of these new districts. So there's lots of things to watch. I think the low turnout might mean that we have some kind of results that surprise people as to the candidates that make it out of the top two. And of course, we have a statewide ballot with candidates running for things like insurance commissioner, controller. Not a lot of attention is being paid to those. Most of those races, the incumbent Democrat is going to just run away with it. But there are some interesting ones, like in the state controller's race, there are a number of Democratic candidates who all are spending money and campaigning, and it'll be interesting to see who comes out of that.
Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's always fun.
Yep, it's a busy time for you, too. Paul Mitchell is the vice president of political data, which tracks voter turnout across the state. Up next, we're going to narrow in on the Sacramento County District Attorney's race, and we're going to lay out CAP Radio's election roadmap and voter guide for important local races. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. For the first time in nearly a decade, Sacramento County will have a new district attorney. District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert is now running for California Attorney General. The county DA race has just two candidates, which means it's likely one will be elected following the June 7th primary. That's just 5 days away. The candidates are Tian Ho, currently Sacramento County Deputy District Attorney, and Alana Matthews, a former Sacramento County prosecutor. Whomever becomes the DA, it will be historic because Sacramento has never had a person of color holding this seat in county history. CAP Radio race and equity reporter Sarah Mises-Tan interviewed both candidates and joins us with a breakdown of this race. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Vicki.
A little bit of history. I mean, District Attorney Schubert elected back in 2014, 8 years in this position. Historically, how often is this position vacated?
Not very often at all. Before Anne-Marie Schubert held this office from 2014 until now, this position was held by Jan Scully, who was Sacramento's district attorney for 20 years. So this position tends to be one that isn't vacated very often, as candidates often run unopposed many election cycles in a row.
Yeah, I briefly mentioned both, regardless of the outcome, I mean, this election is historic. So tell us about both candidates' backgrounds and how or if this will shape how they will lead Sacramento County as the top prosecutor.
Of course. So either way, Sacramento has never had an Asian American or a Black person serve as district attorney. So whether voters decide to choose Alana Matthews or Tin Ho, both will be a historic first for Sacramento. I asked both of them this question, how they thought their race would play into them running, and both talked about how being a trailblazer impacts what issues and values they see as being important. For Alana Matthews, she says her perspective as someone who was raised in a high crime neighborhood and also just as a Black woman in a space that is often very white and male means that she often comes up against people assuming things about her, like that she'll be easy on crime.
Very similar to Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and some of the, you know, biased narratives and accusations she's faced. There's this narrative that I'm going to be soft on crime. And it doesn't come from my record as a prosecutor. It comes from a connection between crime, fear, and race. I'm in the highest demographic of almost every statistic of crime victims. Why would I be soft on crime and let any criminal out when I'm more likely to be the victim?
And for Tin Ho, he says he feels his experience growing up in an Asian community that was often fearful of police is one that's really colored the way he's seeing approaching prosecuting cases.
If you've seen here in the last several years, there's been an exponential increase in anti-Asian hate crime. And there is a perception that Asian Americans do not speak out, do not stand up. And that perception, that stereotype will sometimes make us vulnerable. But I think that I bring a unique perspective being an immigrant, being a refugee, being somebody who was, frankly, growing up afraid of the police, afraid of immigration, but now works with law enforcement. And I think I bring a unique perspective as a result of that.
Both of their lived experiences are going to resonate with so many voters. I mean, you obviously did your research before you interviewed them, but were you surprised by any of their responses?
You know, I think I was surprised by just how personal both of their platforms are. As you heard back there, both of them spoke extensively about their childhood and experiences growing up as part of racialized groups in this country. For Tin Ho, he talked a lot about his experience being an immigrant and a refugee from Vietnam and how his family's experience with communists in the war have shaped his views on the criminal justice system.
The communists came. And so they arrested my grandmother and left my infant father in the care of his five-year-old brother. And without a judge, without a jury, without a prosecutor, they convicted both women of treason and sentenced them to death by a firing squad, executed them. It's not the judge, it's not the defense attorney, but it's the prosecutor who is the gatekeeper to our system of justice because we're the first and last person to ever see a case.
And for Matthews, her experience growing up in Gary, Indiana, being the victim of gun violence and domestic abuse have shaped her views on how she sees the criminal justice system and who has access to it.
I grew up in an area that was pretty much defined by high crime, high unemployment, gun violence, robberies. You know, it was so bad that I was the victim of a drive-by shooting when I was hanging out with my youth group at my pastor's house. But I realized that the criminal justice system is not always available to everybody.
Yeah. Tin Ho currently works with Sacramento County's District Attorney's Office under District Attorney Schubert, but he's obviously his own person. I've seen him prosecute cases, particularly during the Golden State Killer trial. Is he endorsed by Schubert? And how does he compare, or do you think he'll lead differently than what will become his predecessor if he's elected?
Yeah, so Ho has been endorsed by Schubert, but I do think he is taking a more centrist stance. He actively talked about his work with the district attorney's office around things like gun violence prevention, and he mentioned that he would be looking to continue that work. Where he might differ, I think, might be in how he may approach prosecuting cases around homelessness and cases involving the Asian American community. He talked a lot about looking to connect unhoused people to mental health services rather than charge them with petty crimes. And he also touched on the rise in hate incidents against Asian Americans and mentioned he was sympathetic and aware of that. So I am curious to see where he goes there.
Yeah, when it comes to Alana Matthews, she's a former Sacramento County prosecutor, also with the Prosecutors Alliance, which is a group of progressive California prosecutors. How does she stand apart?
Matthews is the more progressive candidate in this race. She is part of the Prosecutors Alliance, like you said, whose members include San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, who is currently going through a recall election, as some folks may know. She has taken a firm stance on not taking law enforcement campaign donations, something that Ho has done, and has said that she wants to be able to create law enforcement reform without her views being tainted by monetary donations. I think that will resonate with some voters. She has given indications that she's looking to be tougher on police reform and police use of force, but she's also indicated wanting to more closely track people with domestic violence and abuse cases against them, as that's a topic that she's very personally close to.
What were the issues that you kind of found was the biggest departure between both candidates?
I would say absolutely the law enforcement donations. Tin Ho has taken just under $15,000 from law enforcement agencies.
I have received both the endorsement and support of law enforcement, both endorsements and financial as well. But when you look at it in terms of the money that I've raised to run as for this office, it's a very small amount of money that I have received for that. The vast majority of money that I receive is from the API community.
And while Matthews has firmly taken none,
I have not accepted money from law enforcement associations. And I always share that I think that's the most pro-police thing that I can do. Because when I have to make a decision that use of force is justified, the community can have confidence and trust that is based on the law and the merits, and not because I'm getting a financial kickback from it.
And of course, you heard Ho there, who said he won't let these donations color the way he approaches prosecuting cases involving police officers. But Matthews, of course, argues that she feels any monetary donation would make it just harder for her to be truly unbiased. I think that was the biggest point.
Yeah, that's a clear distinction between the two candidates. In what areas did you find more agreement?
I think both understand that there needs to be more solutions and not just a kind of quote unquote locking people up approach when it comes to things like homelessness and prosecuting those petty crimes. So things like petty burglaries. Both acknowledge that they come from communities who are often fearful of the police and law enforcement, and that they want to strive to protect these communities.
Finally, Sarah, you also talked about the Sacramento County District Attorney not filing charges against the Sacramento police officers in the 2018 shooting death of Stephon Clark, which was in line with the conclusions from both the state AG and DOJ, but is still criticized by some members of the community. He was unarmed. He was killed running into his grandmother's backyard. Crowds took to the streets protesting his death. What struck you about their responses?
I think both kind of hedged this question a little bit, if I'm being honest, when I asked if they would have done anything differently in prosecuting the officers involved in Stephon Clark's death. Ho was working in the district attorney's office at the time under Anne-Marie Schubert and said while the event was tragic, he ultimately agreed with her ruling along with Javier Becerra's ruling that stated that the officers did not violate the law when they shot him. Matthews said she wasn't familiar with all the ins and outs of the case since she wasn't involved in the decision that was made. And therefore, she said she can't really say if she would have ruled differently in the end, but she did say that she would have handled communication with the community better. Many might remember that Schubert's decision was made at a press conference with a PowerPoint presentation. It's an approach that many community members found cold and removed. Matthews said she would have used this moment to bring the community together rather than have it create divisions. And so I think that is a notable difference, though, of course, Ho has been quick to also point out that Matthews really has not in the end come out in any interview when she's been asked this question, whether or not she would have ruled differently. Mm. So an important note there.
I remember that press conference. I was there. Sarah, thank you for the breakdown. An important race.
Of course. Thanks so much, Vicky.
Sarah Mises-Tan is CAP Radio's race and equity reporter. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're staying in Sacramento, but broadening our focus to include key local races for the primary next week. Early voting is underway, as we discussed earlier in the hour. But as we learned, turnout is lackluster, which means many of you may still be mulling over races, and there's a good amount to sort through. CAP Radio curated a Sacramento voter guide to make the process easier. Joining us with a layout is CAP Radio Managing Editor of Digital Content, Chris Hagen, and CAP Radio News Editor, Chris Hooks. Good morning, Chris and Chris, with a C and a K.
Hey, Vicky. Morning.
All right, Chris with a K. How many races are we talking about in Sacramento?
In Sacramento County alone, there are about 40 different races, both local and statewide. But like, obviously, not everyone is going to vote on 40 different races. It's going to matter where you live. So, for example, people in my neighborhood will vote in about 21 different races, according to my own ballot, including city council member, county supervisor, governor, state assembly member, and some other races as well.
Yeah, that's a lot to go through. What races stand out to you?
If we're looking at city races, then that just really all of the city council races. There are three districts right now that'll completely have new city council members after elections, districts 1, 3, and 5. We may even have a fourth change next year if Eric Ghetto wins, who he represents the District 6. If he wins his race for state assembly, we could have another change there as well. So essentially, the city council is going to have a completely redone dais come next year after elections are all over. If we're looking at the county, other than obviously the district attorney race that Sarah just spoke about a minute ago, you also have the sheriff's race. Scott Jones has been the sheriff for more than a decade. So whoever wins out of assembly member Jim Cooper or undersheriff Jim Barnes has the potential to completely go a different way than we've seen in the past 12 years. Though it should be noted that Barnes was also endorsed by Scott Jones.
Yeah, and we have both of those interviews on our website at Cap Radio. Chris, with a C, from a digital and social lens, what conversations did you have with your team about a game plan to meet people where they are, make the process of getting up to speed as easy as possible?
Yeah, that's really it for us. We always kind of focus on, like, how can we make this as easy as possible for people? Because as we mentioned, like, elections can be overwhelming. I have 22 races I'll be voting on in my neighborhood. So what we want to do is make sure that information is as readily available and easy to get to as possible. Starting with, we have a lot of information just on how to register, how to vote, how to cast a mail-in ballot to make sure that all of your marks get read by the machines, or how to find a place to drop off your ballot, things like that. So you can focus on the actual, like, learning about the candidates. And part of that, we know that, like, obviously there's a lot of different races out there. So we wanted to make it easy for people to find the information just related to the races they'll be voting on. So we partnered with a group called Voters Edge, just another nonprofit, nonpartisan group, on a tool where you can put in your address and get a preview of just the races you'll be voting on and all the candidates there, which is a lot. I checked my 22 races. There are more than 100 candidates. In part because there are 26 people running for governor. You probably don't need to read up on all of them, but the information is available.
And Chris, you're a parent. How do you find the time to go through all of that? That's a lot of time.
Like we mentioned before, I have a ballot sitting on my kitchen counter. I will likely be going over it this weekend. But the good thing about this tool, though, is that you can also save your selections as you go through different races. And so you can kind of research your ballot over time. And then you can either use that to help fill in your mail-in ballot or to print it out and bring it with you on election day. And then the other thing for us, we talked about, and this was something Chris Hooks talked a lot about while we were planning the voter guide, was this is a primary. This is a different sort of election. We mentioned there could be lower turnout. Some of these local races especially could be decided in this election, especially things we talked about like the district attorney's race in Sacramento County, the sheriff's race. And so we went deeper on those races. There are interviews with candidates available as part of that voter guide for sheriff, DA, city council races, board of supervisor races. So especially in Sacramento County, you can go a little bit deeper to learn more about those candidates, since some of those races could be decided.
Yeah. And you're not alone in this. Early voting turnout statewide is roughly 10%, as we learned earlier in the hour. Every registered voter received a ballot, which means we got a good chunk of people who can vote and people can actually still register. Chris, run through the key dates people should know if they want to register, as well if they want to still vote by mail or actually want to go in person.
Yeah. So as long as you're eligible to vote, the last day to register is Election Day. If you're not registered before Election Day, you can just go to your polling location, register on site, and vote on site. The county has to take some time to verify your eligibility, obviously, but after that's done, your ballot goes through. So the same thing is for the case by voting by mail. As long as your post date is Election Day, then your vote will count.
Yep, it is pretty easy and accessible. Chris, when it comes to Cap Radio's website as well as social media pages, in the days leading up to the primary, what can we expect?
Yeah, we're trying to definitely continue to push out this information about, one, how to vote, Like Chris Hooks just said, that you're still eligible to register even if you aren't registered now. And then, yeah, how to learn about those candidates, because as we've learned, there's still a lot of people who are learning about candidates, haven't cast their vote yet. So making sure that information is available. And then also just trying to kind of head off, you know, questions and curiosities from people that we know come up every year. We always get questions about, like, when will results come out and things like that. One of the things that's most read on our website right now around the election is an article that reporter Chris Nichols did last month about why Alex Padilla, the U.S. Senator from California, shows up twice on the ballot. People are seeing that and wondering. He's filling Kamala Harris's term, so we're voting on the remainder of that and then also a new term for him. And then also continuing to push out information about our candidates. We'll be doing a series on our Instagram page, our Instagram account, over the coming days about, you know, especially the sheriffs and DA races, because those are, again, things that could be decided in this election. And so making sure people have that information.
I imagine when it comes to meeting people where they are in recent years, the momentum and demand for digital and social media when it comes during election years has just continues to pick up.
Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of it is that kind of search and curiosity. People are looking for information, and we, you know, try to make sure that that's as readily available as possible when people decide to engage with the election. Because again, in California, it's now a 30-day election season. You know, as soon as people get those mail-in ballots, we have to have that information ready. People are going to start searching for it, or they could wait until the last day. And so, you know, for us, a lot of it is kind of that repetition and engaging with people when they're ready to engage with the election, especially during a primary when, I think as you were talking about before, there isn't kind of like a marquee race that's drawing people out there.
Finally, Hooks, after June 7th, what should voters expect?
They should expect to vote again in November. I mean, it's an exhausting process. We know that. They also, I guess, have to expect that results are going to take some time. We'll get a sense of who's leading later that night and then also in the morning. But it's going to take some time for results to be official.
Yeah, it's going to be some long hours. Chris and Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Vicky.
Thank you.
Chris Hagan is Cap Radio's managing editor of digital content, and Chris Hooks is Cap Radio's news editor. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 80 years ago this week, at the beginning of World War II, the U.S. government opened an incarceration center for people on the eastern Sierra slope of the Sierra Nevada. The people who lived there for 3.5 years were deemed untrustworthy because of their Japanese heritage. Cap Radio host Donna Apodoni visited Manzanar and produced a short feature that aired earlier this morning. I spoke with Donna about what she learned about this unfortunate chapter of American history. Donna, thank you for joining us for such an important piece of really American but also Californian history. How did you first become acquainted with this story?
I knew that the U.S. government had opened incarceration centers during World War II. I had driven past the one in Colorado a number of times. I had heard from a museum in Arizona that these things existed. And then 15 years ago or so, I was driving to Death Valley and I saw the sign on the highway and I stopped in then. And then a few years more recently, decided to go back there and figure out what this story might be and what we would honor and remember about Manzanar.
Yeah, and this is, you know, 80 years later, 2022. Walk us through the backstory. I mean, I think for a lot of us, we obviously remember when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, which was the start of World War II for the United States. But does it begin there?
No, it begins long before that. To me, in my memory of U.S. history, it's like that was the start of the war. Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. But the history and the conflict between the U.S. and Japan had more to do with the economy, had a lot to do with trade, and went back maybe 10 years or so before that. Then Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Then President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, signed the executive order 9066. And these are the words from the order: authorized the forced removal of all persons deemed a threat to national security from the West Coast to relocation centers further inland. And that's what happened. Tens of thousands of Japanese Americans lost their homes.
What was the rationale for this level of incarceration?
Rationale to some, an excuse for some other people. There was that fear that anyone of Japanese descent would reveal something on the West Coast that would just sabotage security and lead to more of a problem with another attack from Japan, which sounds so convoluted, but that was the excuse or the rationale that was given at the time.
When I go back to American history in high school, I don't remember learning about this. Why didn't we study this piece of World War II?
It was conveniently hidden, wasn't it? Most of us didn't learn about this. Rose Masters is a ranger at the Manzanar National Historic Site, and I wanted you to hear what she had to say, because she grew up right down the road from Manzanar. And after she speaks, we're going to hear some statistics about the size of this place.
I grew up 6 miles from here. 6 miles. Like, I can bike here in 30 minutes. And we didn't study this in school. This wasn't that long ago. And so it's shocking to me, because I see it as one of the most important stories in American history.
Manzanar, the size of nearly 500 football fields, was one of two incarceration centers in California. The other was near the Oregon border at Tule Lake. There were also short-term detention centers.
But I do want you to know that this is the historic auditorium built by Japanese Americans who were incarcerated here.
We're at the back of the gym, in front of a large wall of names. It's the size of a movie screen. 11,000 names of the people who were held here at Manzanar.
Wow, 11,000 people at Manzanar alone. But overall, how many people were incarcerated?
More than 120,000 people were in various centers across the country. Their homes were taken, they had to leave their homes, and they were there for the duration of the war.
And what duration, over what period of time?
Well, the executive order was signed in February 1942. The reason we're talking about this week is it was 80 years ago this week that Manzanar opened, and Manzanar closed at the end of the war, November 1945. The rule at the time was they could take only what they could carry. Those were the words that were used at that time. Some of them had nice neighbors who watched over their homes and their farms, but they really took a suitcase or a bag of something, got on trains in large numbers, got shipped to other places. Manzanar is in the middle of the desert on the other side of the Sierra. Really, it really felt very foreign and very abrupt.
Yeah, I've traveled along the Eastern Sierra. I mean, back in the 1940s, was there a town there?
There wasn't a town at Manzanar. Lone Pine is nearby. Bishop is nearby. The military put together these barracks really quickly, and everybody said by today's standards, these would never be allowed. They were new, but they were pretty rickety. They tried to make normal lives there. The kids had a school to go to. There was a hospital on the grounds. The kids had sports teams. They even had a newspaper, the Manzanar Press. But they all sort of put that together themselves. Nothing was really provided other than some basic necessities.
When we think of World War II, we obviously think of concentration camps in Germany and Poland. Are there any parallels to that to Manzanar?
Not in the sense of people being killed. There were people who died at Manzanar, but it was not intended as a death camp. It was not an extermination center as in Germany and Poland. It was really to keep people out of circulation.
Donna, what's so fascinating, and it's just really cool, is you chose to tell the story of Manzanar through photos. I mean, some go back to 1942, but others are from much more recently.
Yeah, there are two groups of photographs that we're talking about here. The old group comes from Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams and some other people who were taking photographs at the time. The people who lived at Manzanar were not allowed to have cameras. So the government hired professional photographers to document what was going on, or at least some of what was going on. You know, you couldn't show barbed wire or anything like that. You could only show the good part. But that's how we got to know what was happening at Manzanar.
So those are the photos from then. What about the photos that were taken now?
When I got to Manzanar, I met four young women who were on a tour. Most of the people on the tour had relatives who had been incarcerated in one center or another. And I noticed as we were going along how important it was for these four young women to be taking their own pictures of themselves in this place where their family, their ancestors had been. So it really was their story that we're telling here. But as I got to know them and listen to them and spend the day with them, I also realized how strong it is in Japanese culture for a current generation to be tied to future generations.
Yeah, we're shaped by the ancestors of our past.
Yeah.
Who did you meet along the way that you decided to, you know, to share their journey?
I'll let you hear a couple of voices. Sisters, Brittany and Brianna, they worked with the ranger to find the exact location where their family had lived.
We didn't even know that we had anybody at Manzanar until I came on the trip last year. It's heartbreaking, honestly.
Back outside, Rose Masters is helping sisters Brianna and Brittany find their family's home.
The one I talked to was Koji Yorita, and so he was here with his older brother and his parents, and okay. I think they had a younger brother named Toshio who was born here.
Okay, got it, cool.
Did you see this the last time you were here?
No.
No, we didn't know the address.
The barracks are gone, but water spigots pop out of the ground every so many feet. Signs with numbers identify where buildings once stood. And the sisters found where their family had lived, Lock 36.
I'm happy to share it with my sister.
Yeah, you can really hear, you know, the excitement that they had making that discovery. Were you surprised that these young people were interested in their family history?
I was a little bit, but I had found out about that connection that's so important in culture. I talked with Gary Okahiro, who is a professor who co-wrote a book about Dorothea Lange's photographs, and he talked specifically about a famous photograph where there's a grandfather with his grandson, but in the background is Mount Whitney. And he explained what that meant.
The angle is really important on that photo, shot from the ground upward to make him, the grandfather, appear monumental like the mountain. But the grandchild is the future that grandfather sees. That means that their family will continue. And that's very important in Japanese culture because ancestors and the descendants of those ancestors form a continuous line so one can be remembered.
So even in their incarceration and despite the trauma and the hardships, there's still this search for a silver lining. It's important to look towards and really focus on the continuation of family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was everyone as excited as Brianna and Brittany? I would imagine there's a lot of complicated feelings.
Very complicated feelings. And some of the people on the tour were excited. Some other ones were reflective. I have two people I want you to hear. One of them is Sarah. Her great aunt is in a very famous photograph. And the other one is Kat. Her grandfather had been sent to live at Manzanar.
She didn't have control of what photo was taken of her or how she was portrayed. But she had her own narrative when she told the story herself.
I don't think you can quite like picture the camps until you're literally on the crunching desert soil and you feel the wind and the heat that they would have felt. So yeah, it's definitely powerful. It's definitely different to be here.
Even though I decided to tell the story of Manzanar through photos, Anyone can tell the story of Manzanar in their own way. They can explore the architecture, the education, the entertainment. There were gardens at Manzanar. Any way you look at it, this is such an important part of American history. And you know the saying, if you don't know history, you're bound to repeat it. So it's something worth looking at.
80 years later, still resonates to this day. Thank you so much for making the trip.
Nice to be here. Nice to tell you about it.
And that is my conversation with CAP Radio host Donna Apodoni, who visited Manzanar, a Japanese internment camp that began 80 years ago this week. You can listen to Donna's feature, Photos from Manzanar, at capradio.org. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple or Spotify. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Christopher Feltz. Joe Barr is CAP Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.